Many of you may be aware that I'm a legal tech. How many years? I remember they made a party when it was like 5,000. They made a big deal about it. So now that was 2 years ago. So we're probably well over that, close to 10,000. Over?
Whatever.
Rabbi Leibowitz also, and the reason that we thought of him so appropriately for this topic, for Kashas, is that Rabbi Leibowitz is very involved and I believe runs the VAD of the five towns. And a lot of the stores that you walk into and you don't have to think about Kashas, it's because Rabbi Leibowitz and his team of the other Rabbanim in the five towns area do all the work beforehand. So hopefully we'll be able to learn from this, and then afterwards we will be able to ask our questions. So thank you to Rabbi Leibowitz. And I'm supposed to mention that Rabbi Leibowitz was Rabbi Englander's Chavrusa back in YU, and hopefully it will be a very meaningful morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. It's always great to be here in Halb, and it's always exciting to be able to talk to you a little bit about Kashrus. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of the things that maybe people don't know, some of the common questions that people have. Just one correction to Rabbi Fogel. I wouldn't say that I run the Vad HaKashrus of the Five Towns. There are a group of rabbis that oversee those who do run it, and I'm part of that group of rabbis, so we're involved on a very consistent basis to find out and to make sure that everything is running properly and that the professionals who are in the stores each and every day are doing their job properly, and when they run into trouble and issues, they're able to bring it to us, and we're able to discuss these things. So I want to talk about a few things, and then maybe we'll just take questions, and if I go over my time, just let me know. So just, okay, so what I want to talk about is, I made a list of five topics to cover, and then you'll tell me if there's more that you'd like to cover. Number one, just very simply, why is Kashrus so important? Why is this a big deal? This is something, as people who have a Kashrus curriculum, I assume you already discussed, so I'll discuss that very, very briefly. Number two, I want to talk about, why is it so important to have a hashgacha? What could go wrong? If you have a frum person that owns a store, that keeps kosher themselves, that's a good person, why would you even need to make sure that there's a proper kosher certification? You'd eat in the person's house, so why would there be an issue with eating in the store? The third thing is, what makes one hashgacha different from another? Meaning, we all know that you go to Trader Joe's or something, and you see a hashgacha symbol, a kosher symbol that you don't recognize, so right away you take a picture of it and you send the picture to your rabbi and you're like, is this one good or not good? So like, what the rabbi just like flips a coin? No good. That one's and this one is good? No, there's got to be something behind it. If they're all backed up by rabbis, there's someone that's putting that that symbol on something. What's the difference between one symbol and the next? Without going into the details of the symbols, just like what could be the difference between one symbol and the next? Number four I want to talk about is locally, over here in the Vat of the five towns, do we believe that it's a good idea that there should be one Kashrus organization that runs all the Kashrus in an entire community? And number five, maybe just to go through some of the misconceptions about Kashrus that people have. So let's go in order, okay? So number one, why is keeping kosher important? So the very simple answer, you tell me the answer. Why is keeping kosher so important? Who decided that it's important? Hashem, right? That's the end of the story. It's a very simple answer, right? But we get the impression from the Torah, as well as from the rabbis, as well as from Chazal, that keeping kosher is of extreme importance. First of all, in the Torah itself, you don't need another book other than just you take a chumash off the shelf, you open up a chumash, and you see there's so many mitzvos and averos that relate to what we eat, that relate to what we consume, what we put in our mouths. There's an isser of behema tameya, of a non-kosher animal. There's an isser of nevela, an animal that's not slaughtered properly. There's an isur of treif, an animal that was sick. There is an isurim of shkatzimurim, masim of bugs and creepy crawly things. There is isurim of tevel, of produce from Eretz Yisrael, where they didn't take trumas and maestros. And erla, something that grows in the fruit that grows in the first 3 years. And hafrashas chala, where if you're not mafresh chala, the whole dough is asur. You have all of these different mitzvahs and many, many more that all relate to what we put in our mouths. And you get the impression of the Torah dedicated, Hashem dedicated so much space in the Torah to kashrus, you get the impression that this is something that is of very, very critical importance. The second thing is that not only from the Torah, but from Chazal, you get the impression that it's something that is even more than a regular mitzvah in a certain sense, in that there's something called timtum halev. Chazal are concerned that when you eat something, have you guys ever heard of that concept, timtum halev? Have you discussed that?
We know it in English.
How do you say it in English? I don't know if there's a good translation for that. Closing of the heart.
Physically healthy and physically healthy.
Right. So the Chazal are concerned for what's called timtum halev, that literally, in a certain sense, you are what you eat. That more so than any other Avera. Let's say a person does an Avera totally by accident, they had no idea, it was not their fault at all, it's what we call an absolute ones, it was a complete accident. So you don't get punished for that, you don't have to even bring a carbon when there's a Beis HaMikdash, there's nothing, you're fine. The Gemara has an expression, ones, rachmana patre. If you did something by accident, did something totally out of your control, not your problem, you're fine. When it comes to kosher, though, even if it's totally by accident, and it's not your fault, and something terrible happened where someone fed you something that was not kosher, and you trusted them, and you didn't know, it still has an impact on a person's neshama. That's the assumption. You're not going to get punished for it, but it has an impact on a person's neshama. A person is less spiritually healthy than they were before. That is unique to kashrus. We don't have that in other areas of halacha. If a person is accidentally mechalel Shabbos, if a person accidentally does any of the other big averos, we don't have this concept called timtum halev. So much so that the Gemara even assumes that if you have a very big tzaddik, that it's impossible that a very big tzaddik would eat something not kosher, even by accident. That it would never happen, because Hashem would never allow them to be spiritually harmed, even by accident, even if it's something that's beyond their control. So kashrus is very, very important. It's something to take very seriously. And as from Jews, you don't need me to tell you that, right? You all know that kashrus is something that's very important. So let's quickly move on to number two on my list. The second thing is, what can go wrong? Why is it important that you have a hashkacha, that you have kashrus on a store? If you have a frum person that owns the store, what could possibly happen? So I would identify three things. There may be more, but I would identify three things that can go wrong. First of all, first and foremost, the majority of problems that come up in kashrus are not purposeful violations. It's not because someone is trying to trick you or someone's trying to get away with something. Most of the things that come up, most of the problems that come up are accidents, they're mistakes. And the level of hashkacha will determine whether the kashrus professionals will catch the mistake or not, whether they'll notice the mistake. But mistakes happen. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, Nevada Kashrus of the Five Towns started a policy that all stores had to install cameras. We found that security cameras, but instead of just for security, to have cameras in the kitchen so that we could always log in and see what's going on in any store at any time. And if ever a mashkiach notices something is out of place, instead of just making an accusation and saying, oh, this is terrible, you must have done something wrong, we can go back to the camera and see what actually happened. Like, why is the thing out of place? What happened over here? And sometimes it helps a lot, because, you know, sometimes something looks off, and in previous years we might have had to make them kosher the whole kitchen because we don't know what just happened. Now we can just go back to a camera and see what actually happened. So the cameras have been a huge help, and it turned out that, like, most stores had cameras anyway. Why do most stores have cameras on the employees anyway? They want to make sure they don't steal. They want to make sure that, there's cameras wherever you go. So we figured might as well, right? And 90% of the stores have cameras anyway. And it was a very, very good innovation. And as many things that we do, it's being copied throughout the country now to have that as part of a standard kashrus contract to have cameras in the store. So we had one store where the mashkiach noticed, a very alert mashkiach, noticed that there was a crock pot with chalent in it, and the crock pot wasn't where it normally was. It wasn't in its normal location. And there were non-Jewish workers in the store, and the mashkiach said, well, how did the crock pot get over there? And he wasn't sure, so we went back to the cameras, and we found that one of the non-Jewish workers saw the crock pot in one place, unplugged it, brought it to a different place, and plugged it in somewhere else. Now, what's the problem with that? What's the problem with a non-Jewish worker plugging in the crock pot? Ah, so a non-Jewish person is not allowed to cook for you. So if they're plugging in the crock pot, that's excellent. If they're plugging in the crock pot, that means that they're doing the cooking because they're turning on the fire. Meaning normally when you turn on a fire, you're turning a knob on a stove. Over here, they were turning on the fire by plugging it in to the wall. That is a violation called Bishul Akum, and we're not allowed to have Bishul Akum. So did the worker do this on purpose? No, of course they told the workers on day one, you're not allowed to turn on the fires, you always have to call Mashkiach to do it, and they knew the rules, but the worker didn't associate, he's not a Jew, he doesn't know that plugging something into the wall is the same as turning on a fire. It was an honest mistake, he had no idea, but thank God we were able to catch it. You're able to catch that when mistakes happen, and that's why we need oversight, and even if the person who owns the store, it's very unlikely that all the people working in the store are going to be religious and are going to understand all the ins and outs of kashrus. So that's one reason why it's really important to have hashgacha, even if the store owner is religious. They're not trying to do anything wrong, but mistakes happen. So you need someone who can be eyes and ears on the ground to make sure that they're able to catch the mistakes. The second reason that it's important is that people don't always know everything that there is to know. We just had an episode recently where a shul had a kiddush and a party planner had bought stuff from all sorts of different places for the kiddush in the shul. And one of the places that they bought from was someone who sells babkas out of their home without a hashgacha, but it's a from person who sells babkas out of their own home. And it turned out that the person who was selling the babkas was not mafresh chala on the, they didn't do mafresh chala on the dough. Now the halacha is if you have a thick dough, like a babka dough, not like a pour over batter. But anyone ever make a babka? Never make a babka. It's a thick dough. It's like the same kind of dough. It's like a bread dough. The halacha is you have to do afresh eschala. And if you don't do afresh eschala, the dough's not kosher. It's really not kosher. You're not allowed to eat it. It's what we call tevel. So you're not allowed to eat it. The person who was making the babkas had no idea that there was such a halacha. They didn't know. They weren't trying to do anything wrong. They're a frum person. They're a religious person. They're trying to do the right thing, but they just didn't know. So sometimes you have where accidents happen. Sometimes you have frum people who just don't know everything that there is to know. So it's helpful to have someone who's well-versed in kashrus to be able to know. And the third reason I think it's important to have hashgacha is that in general, whenever there's money involved, people have a big yetzer hara. There's a big desire or taiva for a person to cut corners when there's money involved. And even very normally good, religious, nice, kind people, sometimes if their livelihood is at stake, might justify things in their mind of why I can get away with this and get away with that, and slowly rationalize in their mind. So if you're trusting the person who owns the store, it's always a little bit risky because that's their livelihood. That's how they make their money, and therefore it can become very tricky. Having said all that, is it beneficial to have a person who runs and owns the store that is religious? Of course it's beneficial. Because if the person who's running and owning the store is also concerned about kashrus, and they're not looking at the people who are giving the kosher certification as like the people who are just overseeing everything I do and are my enemy, but they are my partners. They're helping me provide kosher food for people. There's a fellow that davens in my shul who owns kosher supermarkets. And he said that he feels that Hashem put him on this earth to be able to help people keep kosher, to provide kosher food for people. And those who oversee the store, he has a store in Queens and Teaneck, he has a store here also, not a supermarket here, but a different store here. So he says those who oversee the store are his partners in being able to do his mission of being able to provide kosher food for people. So is it beneficial to have someone who is a religious person that owns and runs the store? Definitely beneficial, definitely helps. Is it enough? No, it's certainly not enough. We also need to have proper kosher supervision. Okay, so now that is point two. So again, how many points did I tell you we're going to do? I don't remember. Five. Okay, you're wishful thinking that it was only three, but it was five. It was five. So we had one was, why is kosher so important, right? So kosher is so important because it's spiritually healthy and because there's so many mitzvahs in the Torah. Number two is, what can go wrong? So we said, what can go wrong? Lots can go wrong. Mistakes can happen, lack of knowledge. When there's money involved, people can make mistakes. Now, number three, what makes one hashgacha different from another? What would make one kosher certifying agency different from another kosher certifying? I gave the Trader Joe's example. You're in Trader Joe's, you know they have a list. You ever see that list, the Trader Joe's list? Anyone ever see that? They have a list of all the different products with all the different kosher symbols that you'll find in different products. There are about 100 different kosher symbols. Trader Joe's has like weird foods, right? So they have like from all over the place, and sometimes you have these unusual. It's not all the OU, OK, Chaf K, Star K that you're used to. It's all different sorts of kosher symbols. So what makes one different than the other? Why is it that all day I'm getting texts with pictures of kosher symbols? I'm in Costco. I'm in Trader Joe's. I'm here. I'm there. Is this one reliable? Is this one not reliable? Shouldn't they all be reliable? They're all run by Orthodox rabbis. So first of all, they're not all run by Orthodox rabbis. Sometimes the symbols are not by Orthodox rabbis. Sometimes it's conservative rabbis also give kosher certification, and they're not necessarily working with the same rules that we're working with. But even the ones that are run by Orthodox rabbis, there are three reasons that I could think of off the top of my head this morning. Three reasons, three primary reasons that make different kashrus different from each other. First of all, there are different standards. There are different rules that some are working with. For example, there are some people that would never have milk that is not Chalav Yisrael. And there are other people that rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein's important opinion that you're allowed to have, in America at least, you're allowed to have milk that is labeled and called milk by the Food and Drug Administration, that we're allowed to assume that that's cow milk and that that's also Chalav Yisrael. But there are some people that would only have milk that is Chalav Yisrael. There are some people that would only have Yashan, that wouldn't have Chadash. There are some people for Svardin that are very makbid on Chalak Beit Yosef, that a certain type of stringency when it comes to meat. There are all sorts of different sets of rules. So you need to know what the standards are of that particular hashgacha. Some hashgachas have just different standards. Lower, higher, different. You need to know what matches you, what matches what you're interested in. So it could be that it's a very good hashgacha, but they're enforcing a certain standard that may not be your standard. So that's one difference between hashgachas. Another difference is that there's a different amount of diligence and predictability. Sometimes you have a rabbi who gives a hashgacha, but you know he'll call the store before he comes. Thank you very much. Before he comes to the store, each time he'll give. There's one. before he comes to the store, each time he'll say, "Oh, by the way, I'm coming. So is it okay if I come right now?" Now that's not a really great idea for him to call each time and say, "Is it okay if I come right now?" Why is that not a great idea? Because they'll say, "Oh, he's coming! Quick, put away the all the problems," and they'll clean up for him. But the amount, or maybe he won't call, but they know that he comes every Tuesday between 3 and 4, and that's the only time he's there. And they figured out how to game the system that they know exactly when the rabbi's going to show up. And sometimes you have rabbis that don't show up all that often. I was talking to one rabbi who gives hashgacha, very nice fellow, very knowledgeable fellow, but he said that his rebbe told him he only needs to visit a store once a year. if a rabbi is only visiting a store once a year, I would never trust that Ashkach Kenu. Who knows what's going on in the store the rest of the time if he's only visiting once a year or if he's visiting only once in a long while. So again, the first difference between Ashkachas is that there are different standards. Second difference is there's a different amount of diligence and predictability. Sometimes there are different practical knowledge of even how to run a Hashkacha. For example, like I said before, some Hashkachas will have cameras, others will not have cameras. Some will know every time Mashkiach walked in and out because they have logs that log exactly when Mashkiach was there, when Mashkiach was not there. They'll know exactly when lettuce was checked for bugs, when they'll know everything because they know how to run a proper organization. And other times it's just like a really firm person who wants to do well but doesn't really understand the ins and outs of running a business and running a store and could miss so many things. And then the third thing that separates different hashkachos is different relationships with the store. Like I mentioned before, ideally it should be viewed as a partnership, that the store owner wants to provide kosher food and the hashkacha is helping them do so. At the same time, they can't have too much trust and too much friendliness, because the people giving the hashkacha have to be able to have the strength to be able to say when something is wrong, and not to say, oh, I don't want to upset the person, I don't want to ruin his day or his business. If there's something wrong, you have to be able to say something. So if there's too close a relationship, so then it could be problematic. I would even say that if there's any, Rabbi Belsky, Zichrono Livracha, used to be one of the heads of kashrus at the OU. He passed away already. So he was one of the poskim together with Mori Verabi Rav Shechter Shlita for the OU, which is probably the most widely recognized kashrus organization in the world, or at least certainly outside of Israel. And Rabbi Belsky said that he has a problem trusting any hashkacha that's given by a person, meaning just one person, because one person misses things. One person will have a relationship. One person, if you have a team of people that are overseeing things, a team of people, so then I might have a relationship with somebody, but someone else doesn't, and therefore they'll be overseeing me, and they'll think of things that I didn't think of. So that's what makes one Ashkacha. Those are some of the things that make one Ashkacha different from another. Fourth point for today, and then we'll get to five, and then we'll take questions. Fourth point for today. Why do some rabbis insist that there be only one Vada Kashrus in a community? In a capitalist society, don't we believe that there should be free market and that everyone should be able to open up whatever they want? So there are a few reasons why it's important to have a single standard. The first is that it's the best way to ensure integrity, to make sure that people are being honest and true and that things are being done properly, is if you take money out as a factor. So usually community rabbis, not in every community, but certainly in this community, the community rabbis don't get paid for kashrus. The payment goes to kashrus professionals who are hired. The community rabbis get no money from it. All the community rabbis get out of it is grief, but and the ability to provide kashrus for people in the community. So when you take money out as a factor, rabbis are able to make better decisions without having to think about, oh, but I need this store, because if I don't have this store, then I'm not going to be able to, if I don't have the payment that they're going to give for the kashrus, then how am I going to feed my family this month? So if the rabbis aren't making any money off of the deal, it helps to provide integrity. Second of all, local rabbis generally understand the needs of the community the best. If you have someone coming in from the outside who's not a member of the community, who doesn't understand the community, they may not understand what the community really needs in terms of kashrus. And third, things become very confusing for the consumer, and this is probably the one that resonates most with people. I assume you've been to Israel. Most of you have been to Israel before. Yeah. So what's kosher in Israel? Like, how do you know it's kosher? Everything, nothing, almost everything, almost nothing. There are like 1,000 different hashkachos. You don't know where to go. You don't know what. You don't even have to go to Israel. Go to Brooklyn. There are 50 different hashkachos. You go to someone's house, you have to ask 50 questions first. Do you keep this? Do you keep that? Is it only Mahadran? Is it Badatz? Is it this? Is it that? And you have to ask 100 different questions. And it becomes very, very confusing for the consumer. When there's a single standard, it becomes much, much easier for the consumer. But wait. If there's a single standard, then what do we do about the problem we said before? Take a look at the five towns, right? You guys are in Halb. There are eighth grade girls that are in Hafter and in Tag and in Benos Beis Yaakov. And am I missing Shalamis and Shalamis and all these schools? Do they all keep the same standards in their homes? Is everyone, by a show of hands, how many people here are not so careful about Chalav Yisrael in their homes? I'm not. Most of you probably are not, right? So, and if I were to take that same poll in, let's say, Benos Beis Yaakov, do you think everyone would raise their hands? Probably not, right? So it depends. There are different standards within our community. How could one hashkacha give hashkacha when there are so many different standards? So there's one simple answer to that question, and that is something that it's one word. It's called transparency. As long as we're open and we make it clear what's what, and that's why you may notice in a lot of the local stores there's a little checklist on the by the front door of the store that goes through. Is it Chalav Yisrael? Is it Yashan? Is it? And that way, right on the spot, you can see. And whatever information you don't see right on the spot, you can go on the Vada Kashrus website where the meat comes from. Everything is right there, so that a person could know whether all of their own personal stringencies are being observed. And then the final thing that I want to talk about before we take questions are maybe some common misconceptions that people have about kashrus. One common misconception, for example, is that if I can buy one thing at a store, at a particular store, then it must mean that I could buy everything at that store. That is not always true. Obviously, if the whole store is under a reliable hashkacha, it's under the OU, or the Vada Kashrus of the Five Towns, under a reliable hashkacha, then that is true. You could buy everything at the store. But let's say you go to a store, let's say you stop in a gas station somewhere, you're driving on the New Jersey Turnpike, you stop to get gas, you go to a rest stop, and there's a Starbucks there in the rest stop. So where do you go? You go and you get a coffee. Is it okay to get a coffee in the Starbucks? Yeah, that's probably okay to get a plain coffee in the Starbucks. But they also have little desserts in the Starbucks. Can I go grab a dessert? So that's not okay. Just because you can buy one item in the store doesn't mean you can buy every item in the store. The thing that a lot of people don't realize, people probably do realize that about the sandwiches. You know, they probably realize the little ham and cheese sandwich is probably not okay. But not everybody realizes that about all of the drinks in Starbucks. Not every drink in Starbucks is necessarily kosher or is using ingredients that are kosher certified. So it's important to know what's what. It's important to know what they use that's kosher and what they use that's not kosher in order to be able to buy anything there. So that's one common misconception that people assume. Oh, a drink is a drink, so it's got to be okay. Not necessarily is it okay. Not all the ingredients of all the Starbucks drinks, I'm just using Starbucks as an example, it could be anything, it could be any store, are kosher. Another thing that people assume is that if I have to be somewhere where there's no kosher restaurant, I can just get a salad. A salad's okay. That is definitely not the case. Why is a salad not necessarily okay? They don't check for bugs, and there are many, many isurim of eating bugs. Eating a bug is really, really bad. Well, why wouldn't they check for bugs? Don't they want to serve something clean? Well, what they refer to as clean may not be up to our standards of clean enough from little insects. And you don't realize, if you go to Gourmet Glot and you see like the pre-checked basil and whatever, you know what I'm talking about? Pre-checked lettuce, you have no idea how much work goes into that. There was a video that the Vada Kashrus actually released together with the OU recently of the basement in Gourmet Glot where they do the bug checking. It is like a whole operation. It is a huge, huge endeavor. Hours and hours and effort is spent to make sure that there's no bugs. A salad is certainly not a salad in a place that doesn't have certification is certainly not okay because of bug checking. Also, very often salads will be dressed, and if there's a dressing, then that obviously could be not kosher. Also, there are often onions and other things in salads which, if cut with a non-kosher knife, even if it was a clean knife, would be problematic. Another common misconception is that frozen yogurt is always fine. You don't need hashkacha on frozen yogurt. That is not true. Frozen yogurt is often fine. It's often kosher, but it could also be not kosher, just like any other product could be not kosher. So a person has to be careful to make sure that the place that they're going to has someone that oversees, that makes sure that the products that they're using are kosher, that it has a reliable hashkacha. Now, sometimes you'll go to a place where it's like a national brand. Let's say you go to a Häagen-Dazs ice cream store anywhere, whether it be locally or you're traveling throughout the country and there's Häagen-Dazs and you want to get yourself some good dulce de leche, you know, like that's the best flavor, right? And you want to get yourself some good. So since Häagen-Dazs only uses Häagen-Dazs products and it's a national, international brand, and if they were to ever use something that wasn't a Häagen-Dazs product, they'd probably get in big trouble. They'd probably lose their license to be running a Häagen-Dazs. And you see that the tub that they're scooping the ice cream out of says Häagen-Dazs on the side, and you see that that they're using their product. So many, many people are okay with that, with getting ice cream at such a place where it's a national brand. They're only allowed to use their product. You see that they're using their product. But that doesn't work for Froyo very often, because Froyo, you don't really see what they're using. They just load up the machine in advance. They're not. You don't know if they cleaned the machine. You don't know what flavor they had in the machine beforehand. And you're just trusting that the person who owns the store says, yeah, it's kosher. We used to have, when I went to high school, in Manhattan called MTA. And in MTA, there used to be a bodega. That's in Washington Heights. It's a large Hispanic community. So little grocery stores are called bodegas. So it used to be a little bodega across the street from MTA. So a very nice Hispanic couple ran this this store. And any MTA student would come in and we'd say, someone would say to the Hispanic store owner, is this kosher? And they would say, everything in bodega kosher. You know, but that wasn't true. Not everything in the bodega was kosher. So just because the store owner says, everything in my store is kosher, I'm only serving you kosher, that doesn't necessarily mean that's true, particularly if the store owner themselves doesn't keep kosher or necessarily know what kosher is. Another common misconception, this I alluded to before, is that kashrus is much better in Israel. That is yes and no. In a certain sense, there are very, very high quality kosher agencies in Israel. There are some very strict standards that are enforced very, very well. But in other cases, there's almost no standards. In other cases, it's got Hebrew letters. It says kasher, but I see milchik and fleishik coming out of the same kitchen. How does that happen? Or I see, it says rabbanut of whatever. I never heard of that city that the rabbanut is from, but is that enough? So in Israel, they both have the highest standards and the lowest standards. You really, really need to know what you're buying from. Now, the reason they have such low standards is not because they're bad or evil or trying to get you to eat not kosher. The reason they have so many hashgachas with low standards is that there was a thought process that if we can offer just some minimal kashrus for everybody, then people who otherwise aren't religious, at least they won't be eating ham sandwiches. At least they'll be eating something that has some minimal chance of being kosher. So they try to make it as broad as possible so that there will be some low, low standard of kashrus for people who aren't religious and who otherwise would be eating non-kosher. Now for us, that would not be enough. For us, that would not be a high enough standard. A lot of people make this mistake. It's a major misconception. A lot of people, when they go to Israel, they just think that anything goes. That if it says Rabbanut of anywhere, of anything, that it's automatically okay. And that is certainly, certainly not the case. So again, just to quickly review, we made 5 points. Number one, we discussed why is kashra so important. And we said because of all the mitzvos and yisurim and because of timtum alev. Number two, we discussed what could go wrong if it's a from store owner. What can possibly go wrong? So we said there are a lot of mistakes that happen. A lot of times the owners don't know everything that they need to know. Also, there's money involved. Number three, we said, what makes one hashkacha different from another? What does it mean? A reliable hashkacha, not reliable hashkacha? So we pointed out that different hashkachas have different standards, different hashkachas have different amount of diligence and predictability, and different hashkachas have different relationships with the store owners. Number four, why do some rabbis insist there be only one valakashos in a local community? Aren't we a capitalist society? So we pointed out that the best way to ensure integrity is to take money out as a motivator, that local rabbis understand the community best, and that things are way less confusing if there's one standard of hashgacha and how we deal with diversity within a community. And number five, we discussed what are some common misconceptions. So we pointed out the Starbucks misconception that everything must be kosher if anything is kosher, the salad misconception, the Froyo misconception, and the Israel misconception that everything is better in Israel. So that's my 5 points that I wanted to make. I'm happy to take questions from if any of you have any questions. Questions? Yes. So it depends who did the initial checking of it. Meaning if it was checked very, very reliably, so there's no halacha that you need to check it again. Right, so that is a good idea to check, take out, let's say it's a bag of lettuce or a bag of baby spinach or something, to take out a handful and check that very carefully, and then you establish a chazaka that probably the rest of it is okay also. But like a Trader Joe's product, it's not the same as a Gourmet Glot product. You know what I'm saying? Meaning they don't have... meaning triple check just means it's power washed. It doesn't mean that anyone was actually checking it for bugs. Oh boy, how am I going to go? Okay, yes. Usually, yes. If it's already cooked, it's too late. But if it's still raw, then yes, you can do that. Yeah. Yes. Whichever. I don't know. Okay. So that's not really true. That's a misconception. Okay. So if two things are very hot still, to put them together might be an issue of cooking basar b'chalav. But otherwise, just putting milk near meat, as far as I know. No, am I missing something? Was there? So putting it in the garbage doesn't seem, meaning it's not really benefit, and it's only a basar b'chalav mixture that you're not allowed to benefit from if they were cooked together. So if you have hot meat and hot cheese, you probably shouldn't throw that on top of each other. That's what they said in Israel. You know, sometimes in Israel people get very agitated about things, so they have all sorts of protests, and sometimes people will start lighting dumpsters on fire because they're protesting, I don't know what, people being drafted in the army or whatever they decide to protest. So they light like a dumpster on fire. So they didn't know how did they get these Haredi Jews to stop lighting dumpsters on fire. So they said, there might be milchigs and fleishigs in the dumpster, and when you light it on fire, you're cooking basar b'chalav. So that's it. They say, oh, then I can't light the dumpster on fire because I don't want to cook basar b'chalav. But as long as you're not lighting your garbage on fire, you could probably throw meat and cheese in the same garbage. Yeah. If it doesn't have a hechsher, I would not trust it. Meaning the problem with gum is not so much the gum base, but there are all sorts of flavors that are added to gum. You ever chew a piece of gum, you notice when you start, it's like a nice big piece, and then 10 minutes later, you take it out of your mouth, and it's teeny tiny? Where did all of it go? You ate it, meaning most of it is sugar and flavoring and things like that. So that you've swallowed all that. That came into your saliva and you've swallowed that and you ate that. So that's why even though a gum base is really nothing, it's just a piece of rubber that you're chewing on, so there's an argument to be made, and some prominent poskim made the argument that maybe a gum base doesn't need to be kosher, but every gum needs to be kosher because it has all sorts of flavoring. So you would need... Okay. I didn't understand. Is that what you were saying? I didn't realize that. Okay. Now, sometimes you'll have a company. Usually, standard kashrus practice is that we would not allow within one country. A reliable kashrus organization typically will not allow within one country that some products to be sold as kosher and some as not kosher with the same packaging other than the kashrus symbol. They wouldn't allow that because it's too confusing. I remember when I did a 3-week summer session with the OU once, and we traveled around to different factories, and at the time Twinkies were not kosher. I don't know if Twinkies are kosher now or not. I don't eat Twinkies, but at the time Twinkies were not kosher, and we were in a Drake's factory. And they showed us that they make Twinkies in that factory also. And the Twinkies they make in that factory are kosher, but they're not sold anywhere as kosher. Because other factories make Twinkies that are not certified. So they can't allow these Twinkies to be certified, even though they're perfectly kosher, because other ones are not. So typically, within a single country, they would not allow that. However, what often happens is that you'll have a product that's made in Israel and a parallel product that's made in America or Europe. So the one from Israel is under kosher certification and maybe uses even different ingredients than the one from America or Europe, which maybe is not under kosher certification. So I would think, without any direct knowledge of the particular gum, I don't really know directly, I would think that probably one product is an Israeli product and the other one is not, in which case it's, you know, you should be makbid to only buy the one that has, you know, the kosher certification.
Are you allowed to eat in restaurants that are under like a different bar than like this community?
So if you're in a different community and they have a reliable VAD as well, so yeah, then you have to make sure that in that community that they have a reliable kosher certifying organization. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. Because five gum in Israel maybe is kosher, but maybe the five gum that they sell elsewhere. It's probably a good example of exactly that question. Wow. Okay, pig gelatin is not a good thing. That's not something we want. Yes.
From before, by someone's question about the cholent, if, let's say, the cholent had already been fully cooked and then he just unplugged it, plugged it back in just to, have it, to keep it hot,
so that is not as bad, but that would not technically be problematic. But the in general, when you're trying to run a restaurant, you want to make sure that the workers don't make their own call in terms of what's acceptable and what's not. You want to make sure that you have rules in place that problems can't happen in the back. Yes. I can't hear you louder. So Rav Moshe Feinstein had a very important tshuva that he wrote many years ago, where he said that there is a halacha called Chalav Yisrael. No one disagrees. One is only allowed to eat Chalav Yisrael. The question is how we define what's called Chalav Yisrael. Does Chalav Yisrael mean that a Jew has to see the cow being milked? Or does Chalav Yisrael just mean that a Jew has to know that this milk came from a cow? So Rav Moshe Feinstein said the second way. That is, as long as you, and he wasn't the first one to say this, Pri Chadash, others say, as long as you know that the milk came from a cow, even if you didn't see the cow being milked, Rav Moshe Feinstein thought that that's called Chalav Yisrael. And he thought that since there are government regulations that will not allow a company to sell something and just call it milk, they could call it almond milk, they could call it goat milk, but to just call it milk, they're not allowed to do that unless it comes from a cow, and there's testing done on the milk randomly, and they would get fined if they were found to mix something else into the milk. So he says, a Jew does know that it's from a cow, and therefore that is Chalav Yisrael. So certainly it's a correct question. There's no such thing as non-Chalav Yisrael being okay. It's just how we define Chalav Yisrael. Most people in this room, myself included, have a broader definition of Chalav Yisrael. That Chalav Yisrael includes not only when a Jew saw it being milked, but when a Jew even just knows that it comes from a cow, that's good enough. Somebody heard a question? Yeah.
So if you have non-Jewish workers in your store, then how does it work that they can't cook it?
So this is a big difference between Sfardim and Ashkenazim, actually. For Sfardim, Sfardim have a certain stringencies, Ashkenazim have leniencies, and sometimes it works the other way. But over here, it's a stringency that Sfardim have that Ashkenazim don't. For Ashkenazim, the halacha is that even if a Jew just turns on the fire, then the non-Jew can put the food on the fire and do all the cooking, and that's considered that the Jew did it. It's called Bishul Yisrael, it's not called Bishul Akum. So that's why maybe in some of your homes, you may have a housekeeper in the house where you know that you have to turn on the fire if they're going to, cook noodles or something, right? But for Sfardim, that's not enough. Turning on the fire is not enough. For Sfardim, the Jew has to be the one to actually put the food on the fire. I remember my first year teaching in DRS. I taught in DRS for many years before going on to teach elsewhere. My first year teaching in DRS, I had my whole shiur over for a Shabbos, for a whole Shabbos, and my wife had a housekeeper helping in the kitchen when she was making the chicken cutlets. She was frying the chicken cutlets. So my wife turned on the fire. My wife was breading the chicken cutlets, and then the housekeeper was frying them in the frying pan. And we realized halfway through that that's not good enough for the Sephardic students. I had like 7 Sephardic students in the shir. So we had to make a separate batch of chicken cutlets that my wife herself put on the fire for the to make sure that it was kosher enough for the Sephardic students as well. But many of the stores, those are different standards that you have. But that's what most of the Ashkenazi Ashkachos will rely on the Ashkenazi leniencies. Yeah. Yeah, so when they co-own a store, a Jew is not supposed to do business with ma'achalos asuros, with non-kosher food. So it is a problem for a Jew to own a non-kosher restaurant. It's not necessarily okay. It's a real problem if a Jew owns a non-kosher restaurant. Sometimes I have a very close friend who's Baal Tshuva, and the family, the grandparents, started a very famous non-kosher steakhouse. So they own this non-kosher restaurant. So it's a problem for the next generation, if they're frum, to take over that business, because you're not really supposed to do business with non-kosher food. Yeah, so that's a good point. Meaning, sometimes when you have, let's say, a lower standard of kashrus, so does that mean that you're eating pig? Sometimes you're like, Rabbi, is this pig? Am I eating pig? I can't tell you that you're eating pig, but let's say, if I could tell you you buy something with no U, you could be 99.9% sure that what you're eating is perfectly fine. With some other kashrus, you can only be 90% sure that what you're eating is fine. And for most of us, I would assume, 90% is an unacceptable risk. We're not willing to take that kind of risk. One can never be 100% unless you picked the vegetables, you made everything from scratch, you saw it with your own eyes, so we can never be 100% sure. But we want to be as close to 100% sure as possible, and that's why we have these wonderful kashrus organizations that know what they're doing, and that put in systems to make sure that things go well. Yeah. And hibachi, those places where they do the fancy stuff, do they turn on the stove?
Yeah, they always turn it on when they're sitting.
No, doesn't Mashkiach come and light it? I've only been once. I've only been there once.
I think it might be on the floor.
They
can just like
they spray it. Oh, okay. If there's a little bit of a fire and the non-Jew is making the fire bigger, that's good enough also. Yeah. So probably the Mashkiach lights the fire, and you just see he takes something and it goes, and then he juggles things and throws them in your mouth and does all that fun stuff that, whatever. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, to own a kosher one. To own a non-kosher one is problematic, meaning the non-kosher Dunkin' Donuts will have real non-kosher food there, meaning it's not like, oh, there's just no ashkacha. They'll have bacon. They'll have, we used to have in the local Dunkin' Donuts, we used to have fakin. They used to have fake bacon. And you'd be there sometimes, and, someone who's not Jewish would come in and would say, I'd like a bacon and egg and cheese or whatever. And the worker will say, it's fake bacon. And they'd be like, what? why is that? Now we don't even have the fake bacon because it's just too risky to have even the fake bacon, because the same Dunkin' Donuts truck will do deliveries to all the Dunkin' Donuts in the area, in the region, and we just need, just one time a mistake happens and they drop off the bacon instead of the fakin, and you get in big trouble. That would be a real problem. So a Jew can certainly own a regular Dunkin' Donuts. There are other issues that might come up, because Dunkin' Donuts typically have to be opened on Shabbos also, meaning there are rules of the franchise, and that could be very complicated for a Jew. But in terms of kashrus, it doesn't seem like there's an inherent problem. Yes? So it has, actually, this is what we talked about before, that there are different, this covers two of the topics we spoke about before. Which two topics? Oh, okay, you got to pay attention. So this covers the topic of different hechsherim with different standards, that not every hechsher has the same standards, and also the idea of a single hashkacha within a neighborhood in order to ensure, in order to ensure the quality assurance within the neighborhood in terms of the Ashgacha. So I wouldn't, I think it would be unfair to say about some place that has any Ashgacha that it's not kosher, but I am more comfortable saying that it may not be the standard of kosher that the rest of the neighborhood typically holds by or would be comfortable with. Yes?
How are people not nervous that, like, donuts and Dunkin' Donuts might not, like, touch the bacon that they had there? Like,
No, we don't have bacon in kosher Dunkin' Donuts.
No, and, like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, non-kosher Dunkin' Donuts will have bacon. A kosher Dunkin' Donuts does not have bacon. If you see bacon in a kosher Dunkin' Donuts, report that immediately. That is a major violation. Yes.
If you're on like a trip or something and you want to get like a coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, can you get a coffee in place
of bacon? So the practice was always and seems to continue to be that buying coffee from just about anywhere is okay if it's just plain coffee. Once it gets fancier, then it gets tricky. But if it's plain coffee, I would buy a plain coffee in a regular Dunkin' Donuts. Hello, Rabbi Englander. Shalom Aleichem. Nice to see you. Yes. Can we be more specific? Because I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. I don't think there's a rule that you can trust drinks more than other things, but with plain coffee, there's very little that can go wrong. Once it gets fancier, like I said, I don't think there's a rule that you could just trust whatever.
Can you just elaborate on what plain coffee is and what fancier coffee is?
Plain coffee means like black coffee, then you could add your own sugar and your own milk. Milk is milk, that you can also trust. But once it gets any with flavored, lattes and frappuccinos and whatever, then you really need to make sure that you know what's actually being put into it. I'm not saying that it's not kosher. You just have to know. You have to know what's being put into it. Sometimes they'll put in a flavoring. It's just a pump, a flavor. And you could just ask them, can you show me what you're pumping out of? And they'll show you the bottle and it has no U on it. And that's fine. If they're taking your regular coffee and going pump, 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 right, with something from something that has no U, that would be okay also. But you can't just assume. You have to actually know what they're putting in.
If it's in, like, a non-kosher store, how do you know that the stuff that it's being held in is, like, kosher?
The stuff that what's being held in?
Like, the coffee.
So coffee is made in coffee machines, and all they really can make is coffee. In coffee machines, so that's the and they wash it out in between. Yeah.
You mentioned we can't get like salads at like a non-kosher store. Are you able to get like fruit?
Very good. So fruit, depending on the fruit, meaning some fruits are bug sensitive also. Like in a fruit salad, you'll often have strawberries or blackberries or raspberries. Those could also be bug sensitive fruits. You also have to make sure. It's a lot better than a vegetable salad. But you'd want to know that the fruit has been cut with a clean knife and not with some trefa knife that wasn't clean, and that there are no lemons and other. I mean, you have to really know a lot in order to be able to know for sure. Most often, like a supermarket or like let's say a fruit store. Let's say we have local fruit stores here that are not under hashkacha, but all they sell is fruit. And sometimes they'll sell fruit platters with cut up cantaloupe and honeydew and whatever. So as long as you make sure that you're not buying with strawberries and things like that that need checking. So all they're cutting with their knives is fruit. That's all they have. So I think in those cases it would be okay to buy even from a fruit store without hashgacha. Yeah, so with onions it's very tricky because onions, there's something called a davar charif, that which is very sharp. So like an onion give me other examples of something. A lemon sometimes is viewed as something that's a davar charif. So we normally assume in order for flavor to transfer from the knife to the food, you need heat. Something needs to be hot. But if you have something that's very sharp, we assume in halacha that the flavors that are in the knife can get transferred to the food that it's cutting, even if it's cold. So that's why if you use a dairy knife, the dairy flavors will go into the onion when you chop an onion. Very good question. So this is another difference between Sephardim and Ashkenazim. This is one where the Sephardim are more lenient than the Ashkenazim. The Sephardim hold, and it seems to be that this is probably more accurate scientifically, Sephardim hold that glass cannot absorb any flavor of anything. So you can use the same glass dish for hot meat, hot cheese, and not at the same time, but you know, for hot meat, and then the next day use it for hot cheese. Ashkenazim would not allow that. However, drinking glasses, where you're just drinking cold drinks, could probably be used both at a fleishig and milchig meal, because it's not handling anything hot, nor is it really handling anything that's actually meat or dairy. So a drinking glass is probably different. Yes. It's a great question. The Gemara learns this out from Psukim, that that there's a difference between fish blood and animal blood, that halachically, for whatever reason, fish blood is not considered blood. It's not considered problem. Even animal blood is not all usr. Meaning, for example, you ever have a steak cooked rare? Yeah? So there's red stuff coming out of it. So what's that? So we like to call that in halacha, we call that meat juice. What do you think meat juice is? So the halacha is that we have to do what's called melicha. We salt meat. We learned melicha together. So we salt meat, and when and that draws out all of the problematic blood from the meat, and then the meat gets rinsed and washed in a certain way, and whatever's left after a proper kosher salting is no longer halachically called blood, even though it looks like blood, it tastes like blood, but it's no longer halachically called blood, and therefore that's kosher. So fish blood, the Gemara derives from Psukim that the fish blood is not a problem.
How do you check like a closed fruit, like an apple or like an orange?
So fruits that are not likely to have bugs, that are extremely unlikely to have bugs, don't need to be checked. Only fruits that are likely to be infested need to be checked. So apples, it's true that every once in a while someone will take a bite into an apple and there might be a worm in it, but it's very unlikely. It is very uncommon. And therefore, one does not need to check every apple before you eat the apple. Yeah, anything that's, you know, some posts can assume less than 5%, less than 8%, less than 10%. Anything below a certain threshold of percentage having a bug problem probably does not need to be checked. Even though, with some of those fruits, if you eat 10,000 of them throughout the course of your life, chances are at some point you probably ate a bug, but the halacha does not require us to go crazy about checking everything, even when it's very unlikely. Yes?
So if someone's washing their
fruit
with, like, dish soap, does
that have to be kosher? So soap, in general, is not edible. And therefore doesn't have to be kosher. No, it is very effective as a wash, meaning it's very effective to loosen up any bugs that might be attached to the fruit. But there are soaps that do have an OU on it, but I don't think that's necessary to have a kosher soap.
You're like adding, thinking like you're
more likely to get worms. Right, because they haven't already been chosen. But I still don't think it's 10%. I think it's like way less than that. I can do a few more.
Okay, a few more minutes, that's great.
If we're going apple picking and like, let's say, or like berry picking, and like, since
so again, berry picking, correct. Apple picking, I'm not so convinced that it's a problem. It's okay. Yeah, so the short answer is because they used to not have plastic. So Chazal never made a gzeira on plastic. Plastic was a composite that was made later on. But Tevilas Kelim, the actual din of Tevilas Kelim, is in the Torah, and it identifies the metals as things that you have to tovel. Anything that's not metal, midoraisa, doesn't need to be toveled. Glass is you have to tovel, but only midrabbanan. The rabbis included glass. They never included plastic. There are some poskim that hold that you do have to tovel plastic because they say, had the rabbis had plastic, they would have made such a din, so therefore we should. But generally speaking, we assume that you don't have to tovel plastic.
First meal or second, going to
A little louder? Tomatoes, yes? I would think so. How often are tomatoes infested? I would think you could just clean it off and it would be okay. I'm not 100% sure, but I think so. Maybe we'll do three more questions. Is that okay? Three more? Maybe Rabbi Englander will call on the last three so that I won't have to choose. Okay. Ah, very good. So if it's a, first of all, when a kli has not been toveled, you're not allowed to drink out of it or eat out of it, but it does not make the food that's in it not kosher. So if they then take that not toveled, glass container and pour it into a plastic cup, you are allowed to have the food out of the plastic cup. Second of all, the requirement for tevila, this is the more important point, the requirement for tevila is only if it's owned by a Jew. If you're going into a random Starbucks that's owned by a non-Jew, then they don't have a requirement to tovel any of their utensils. If you go to a hotel, let's say, and they have like glasses in the room and you want to take a drink of water out of one of the glasses, you don't need to tovel it. And the hotel, certainly the Hilton or wherever that you're staying at, if it's not in Israel, is probably not owned by a Jew. But that's okay, because you go to Continental Breakfast and whatever, right? Any of you ever been to like any of these hotels that have like a continental breakfast, so you want to get just a glass of milk or orange juice or something, so that's fine to use those kalim because they don't need to be toveled since it's owned by a non-Jew. It's an excellent question. Oh, Rabbi Englander is going to...
I just want to get people who
have
not asked a question, right?
So what's the point of toveling? If I can make a drink in something that wasn't toveled and then pour it into a plastic cup, what's the point of toveling?
Good. Good question. There is a mitzvah to tovel, and you're not allowed to make the drink in the thing that's not toveled. It's just that it doesn't make the drink not kosher. Meaning, you understand? Meaning, it's usher to use a kli that is not toveled, but the food that's in that kli will still be kosher later on. Good?
Yeah?
Okay.
Say like you're required to like brush your retainers with soap and you put it in your mouth like right after, like aren't you like eating soap? Like you get soap in the
end. That may be gross, but that's not not kosher. So if it may taste a little gross,
like,
but
you have the soap in your mouth.
That's a little gross, but
is that soap like that kosher?
So it's a good question. The rule is that something that's not edible, even if there are non-kosher ingredients, but if it's not edible, if it's a human being would never eat it purposely, then it is not a kashrus problem. We derive that from a pasuk. The Gemara derives that nevela haru'uya leger kriya nevela, that only non-kosher that a human being would be comfortable eating is considered not kosher. Even if it's nevela, meaning it's really something not kosher, but it's gotten to the point where it tastes gross and no human being would eat it, it is then not a violation, not a kashrus violation. So if you accidentally eat a little soap and there was no OU on your soap, you're fine. Okay, thank you all very much. You guys have been wonderful.
I hope you